With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
I'm Maya Lau, and this is Other People's Pockets, the show where I ask people how much money they make and how their finances work so that the questions we all have about money can be a little bit less of a mystery. As always, please give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and follow me on Instagram and TikTok at It's Maya Money. Email me with your guest ideas at otherpeoplespockets@gmail.com. Your support really helps the show.
I feel American. I grew up here since I was 6 years old. I don't want to leave. This is my home. I have incredible friends, family. I'm married to a U.S. citizen now, and we see our future in the U.S. So my dream is that I get to one day become a U.S. citizen, you know, retire, and then reap from the 401k that I have been investing throughout my life.
Today, I'm interviewing Daishi Miguel Tanaka, an immigrants' rights advocate based in Washington, D.C. Daishi is originally from Japan, born to a Japanese father and a Filipina mother. And starting from when Daishi was six, he and his family lived in the U.S. as undocumented immigrants. Currently, Daishi has DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which is an immigration policy that allows temporary protection from deportation for people who are brought to the U.S. as children. This is one of the episodes that I'm doing where I'm probing how the Trump administration is affecting people's personal finances. I wanted to talk to Daishi to learn about the financial realities of being a DACA recipient under Trump and how he views his financial future when so many things about immigration policy are changing so rapidly. We spoke on June 18th, 2025. And now, here's my conversation with Daishi Miguel Tanaka.
I grew up in Japan, in Shizuoka, Japan, right underneath the mountain shadow of Mount Fuji. And I grew up in a family of Japanese temple carpenters. My dad is a third generation Japanese temple carpenter. My mom is Filipina. She's from the Philippines. They met and they had me.
They met in Japan?
They met in Japan. Mm-hmm. That's right. And my grandpa on my mom's side is a U.S. citizen. And so there was a part of wanting to reunite with our family in the U.S., who has been U.S. citizens for a long time. And so there was an element of wanting to move to America for the family reunification piece. At the same time, I wanted to become an attorney. I wanted to help other people through the law. And
this was when you were a kid? You wanted that?
You know, this is really funny. My parents retell the story of me watching TV when I was maybe like 3 or 4 years old, seeing refugees on TV fleeing some sort of war or disaster. And they told me that I was asking them, how can I help them? What can I do? And my mom was like, maybe you should just be like a superhero, right? And trying to appease my four-year-old brain at that time. And I was like, how do I become a superhero? And my dad was like, well, you can become an attorney. You can help people. And I said, how do I become an attorney? So my dad said, well, if you want to be the best attorney, you should go to Harvard. And I said, I want to go to Harvard. And he's like, great. And so they started the paperwork for us to get our visas to go to the U.S. Like, this is This is how that, it actually
that is
happened.
The conversation that was led a conversation. To them doing the paperwork to going to the U.S.
That's right. And so we got our tourist visas. I remember signing my little kanji characters, which are like Chinese, Japanese characters, my name on my passport when I was really young, I think at 6 years old. And we moved to the U.S. in 2004. So this was post 9/11, you know, early 2000s era. And we moved to L.A. where my grandpa and my mom's family members have been living. And so that's where we got started. We were expecting to get our family-based green cards in an easy way because in our immigration system, if you have a family member who is a U.S. citizen, they are able to sponsor their children to come to the U.S. and receive a green card, and that would be a pathway to receiving U.S. citizenship if they choose. And so my grandpa sponsored us.
And that works even though he's your grandfather, not your
That's right.
father. Okay.
The way this works is that my mother is the child of my grandfather, but I will be counted as a dependent. So the children of the individual being sponsored will count as part of that. Unfortunately, what we didn't know at that time was that the immigration system was severely backlogged. So we had no idea that at that time it would have taken maybe 10, 15 years for any response from the government to happen. And so we signed in our paperwork and we're just waiting. And to be quite frank, I don't think we really received the best legal representation, you know, to give us all that information. And so we kind of kept on waiting. And we had a tourist visa that was for maybe around 90 days. So it was pretty short. And I remember I was going to school at that time. I went to first grade elementary school in Southern California. And I saw kids of all shapes, sizes, colors, all backgrounds, holding their hands over their hearts under the flag. And that was just like this awakening moment that, wow, this country is a beautiful country. Everyone looks so different and people are so welcoming. And I just fell in love. I remember going back home and telling my parents, like, I want to stay here. I want to learn here. I want to grow here. And so they made a really difficult decision to oversee our visas in order for us to just wait until we get our actual green cards while I go to school. And that started an entire new chapter of our lives being undocumented immigrants in the U.S.
Yeah. And so basically the hope was that even though you overstay the tourist visa, and you were undocumented immigrants, that you still would have a path through the grandfather to legal residency.
Correct. It was our genuine intent was to just receive our green cards that we were legally qualified for and that we thought the U.S. government would deliver. We kept waiting and waiting to never really hear back. Now, because of that, my parents had to find ways to provide for me and themselves.
Do you have any siblings?
No, it's just me. So mm-hmm. I'm the only child. So my dad had to really give up his career of being a Japanese temple carpenter for obvious reasons in America, which is there aren't a lot of Japanese temples. Around that time, there was 2008 recession. And so there wasn't a lot of construction opportunities as well. And so he had to work as a handyman, trying to find any little thing he could do just to put food on the table. And my mom ended up working in nursing homes as a caregiver, being extremely underpaid, you know, often like $6 an hour, working 60-hour days. And it was really hard.
And did your parents speak English?
My mom spoke English and my dad just made do.
Yeah.
So my dad, given that he was working in handyman work and in basic construction, he was often working with Mexican, Honduran, Guatemalan coworkers who were also undocumented. And so it was this really interesting racial solidarity that was happening that we did not expect or that looking back, I look at it in such joyous sentiment because how my dad was able to have these unseen, multilingual, transcontinental connections with people that he may have never have met
yeah.
without being in this sort of situation that unites us, which was lack of legal documents and being cash basis workers.
Right. Did you or your family ever encounter anyone who said, look, I mean, you're coming from Japan, which is not the worst place to live in the world. You're not fleeing violence as many immigrants are. Like, ever thought of going back if life in the U.S. is as tough as it is?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was always the calculus for us. We can always go back to the way things were. But what they believed in was my future. I really loved going to school in America. I thrived. I learned English within 3 months. I made a lot of friends.
At the age of six?
That's right. Yes.
Wow.
I learned English very quickly. I thrived in the classroom. I just love being in America.
What part of LA were you in?
Mostly in the San Bernardino County for the elementary and middle school, mm-hmm. and then in the San Fernando Valley for high school. And the community that I grew up in wasn't really Japanese at all. I was often the only Japanese person in the 50-mile radius. I grew up in a deeply Honduran, Guatemalan, Mexican community. And what was so special about that was that either my friends themselves were, or they had family members who were undocumented. And so when talking about things like our future and the anxiety that we may have about not being able to afford college or work legally, or melancholy that we feel when some of our friends might go to a Euro trip or somewhere abroad and we know we can't do that. We all had this like understanding. We didn't have to say it out loud, but we all knew deep down.
And just explain that. So when you're an undocumented immigrant living in the US,
yeah.
you can't go on a trip to Paris because you can't leave the US. Otherwise, you will probably not be let back in.
That's correct. So if you lack legal status, or you have maybe a temporary visa without a easy way to leave the country and return, if you leave the country, there's no guarantee that you're let back in through Customs Border Patrol. And so you can be locked out. Now, one of the big dangers of our immigration law is that if you accrue what's called illegal status, so you don't have any documentation and you're living in the country for an X number of days, if you leave the country, you trigger a ban from returning. So this ban could range from 5 years to 10 years. And so the way our laws have been set up, and this was set in 1990, it really disincentivizes people to actually leave. So my parents knew if they ever left for whatever reason, they won't be able to see me for a long time. And so they just had to stick it out until our green cards actually came in the mail, which unfortunately it never did. My grandpa ended up passing away before we even got to our place in line. And so our entire application was voided.
Because the grandfather has to be alive for that process to go through.
They have to be alive. I think there are certain legal exceptions, but yeah, in our situation, it did not work out.
How old were you at that point?
I was in my 20s, I think. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. But my life was very different in that situation because I had DACA, and DACA was a temporary status that I held since high school.
Mm-hmm.
So while my parents did not have any protections, I had something to go on.
So what did getting DACA when you were a teenager change for you about the kind of financial life that you could have in the US?
So before I received DACA, I wasn't really sure what my future held. I wasn't sure if I would be able to work a normal job, even if it's just like working at McDonald's or, you know, any teen job. I wasn't sure if I was able to get that. And so it was really uncertain for me about what I would have done to try to provide some financial stability for my parents, because as my parents worked in really grueling, backbreaking labor industries, I knew that I had to provide for them at some point. Once I received DACA, because it gives you a work permit that you must renew every 2 years, and another paperwork that says that you are deferred from deportation actions, it unlocked an entire new menu of options for me.
And you can have a driver's license.
I could have a driver's license. I could apply to work legally at any job in America, aside from certain federal government jobs. Most jobs are available to us with that work permit. And I also had the confidence to be able to go out of state and just venture on my own to attend college. I thankfully did graduate high school and became the first from my high school to ever attend an Ivy League university. And I made it to Harvard.
Do you feel like being a Japanese DACA recipient gives you at all more of a feeling of protection, or like that you can be louder about your immigration advocacy because maybe you know that at the end of the day, like worse comes to worse, you could go back to Japan?
I think so. Absolutely. So there is a lot of privilege coming from a country that isn't going through an active war or terrible famine or internal displacement.
Gang violence, yeah.
Right. So I hold near and dear individuals who may be undocumented in this country who are fleeing some active persecution or violence that is a real danger to their lives. And I think for that reason, I felt even more responsibility to not just fight for API, Dreamers, or undocumented folks. So has given me so much perspective in trying to fight for protections of other people. And so I think that's where the interracial solidarity comes in, you know, because I grew up in a heavily Latino community. For me, fighting for Latino immigrants wasn't something that felt a zero-sum game for fighting for my rights.
Yeah.
I think if I was advocating for my neighbor, if I was advocating for my friends, then we all win. We all benefit.
So how much money do you make as an immigrants' rights advocate?
Yes. So in Washington, D.C., I conduct policy research and analysis, and my job is about being the bridge between the fire hose of developments from the White House and Congress and the courts and the communities that need that information. And so I've been very fortunate to be able to work in various organizations and climb the ladder. I currently make around $145,000 a year with benefits and all of that. I'm currently at a director level, so I manage people who help me with the work that we do. And so I currently make $145,000, which is on the higher end for maybe what this industry looks like.
And what has the Trump administration done for your life, your outlook, your personal finances? How has it changed the way you're thinking about your work and the money that you can make in the future?
So I've had DACA for a long time. And DACA, again, is this like 2-year work permit that you must renew. And unfortunately, DACA has been challenged in the court system for a very long time, putting a lot of dreamers like myself in a very tenuous position to fully have stability in their financial outlook. Any moment, the court system can strike down DACA and end the program entirely.
At any moment.
At any moment. Now, I think right now it will be appealed to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is about to take the issue in some near future, and then we'll see what happens in terms of the fate of the program. But the Trump administration can also proactively take efforts to completely end the program. I think DACA recipients are very lucky in that that hasn't happened yet, but it can.
I mean, in some ways, I'm shocked that that hasn't already happened. Why do you think that is?
I don't know exactly what they're thinking, but I can guess. So within the first 100 days of this Trump administration, they've taken a lot of efforts to roll back work permits for other categories. As of June, they ended various temporary protective status programs for individuals in Afghanistan, Cameroon, Nepal, amounting to hundreds of thousands of people losing their work permits, as well as other parole programs for Cuba, Haiti, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and so forth. And so the administration is actively trying to revoke work permits of recent migrants. And so we, as Dreamers and as DACA recipients, ostensibly should be part of that fold. But for some reason, the Trump administration hasn't taken a real active approach in trying to immediately revoke our work permits. I can't say exactly why they're making that calculus, but I would say this. For a long time, the issue of undocumented children in the U.S., DACA recipients, Dreamers alike, have been a real long bipartisan issue. It has enjoyed support from members of Congress from across the aisle. Even in the first Trump administration, there was a lot of blowback, political blowback, that the Trump administration faced when they wanted to end the DACA program. And so it really led at that time, back in, I think, 2017, for President Trump to take a more softer approach on DACA, calling on Congress to create some sort of bipartisan deal that would regularize the undocumented youth community. And so I think the Trump administration seemingly may not be prioritizing DACA as a thing that they work on compared to the other heinous things that they're doing, which is conducting worksite raids, a mass deportation campaign against immigrant communities across the country, which is horrific in its own right, but it does take a lot of capacity and time for them to implement.
There's only so much that they can do at one time.
Yeah, they're doing a lot, that's for sure.
Yes.
But it doesn't seem to be that revoking DACA is something that they're prioritizing at this moment. Who knows what they'll do in the near future? And hence, I think I'm uncertain about what would end up happening with my DACA status, along with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who also have the same status.
Do you own a home in the U.S.?
Oh, no, I rent.
Okay. Do you have investments, like retirement investments? I'm just curious if you have that and if you're thinking about which country you want to really be holding your money in.
Yeah. So immigrants who aren't green card holders or U.S. citizens, but are legally able to work in America, still have to pay taxes. And taxes that, you know, go to, towards the federal government, state government, city government, that makes sense. But we also have to pay Social Security and Medicare, things that we don't qualify for, right? So I have been giving a big chunk of my income towards programs that I may not be guaranteed to be able to reap from in the future. So there's a real disconnect and sort of inequities within our taxation system that affects immigrants specifically. When it comes to my retirement, yes, so through my employment and my working years, I've been able to put some money into a 401k, which then I hope that I am able to take advantage from when I retire in the U.S.
And so you're not making a plan B for what if, you know, even though you're married to a U.S. citizen, that doesn't mean that you're automatically a U.S. citizen. And there are things that could happen with the Trump administration. I'm not trying to fearmonger. I'm just saying there are things that could happen that would mean tomorrow you need to think about a plan B. I mean, are you thinking that way? Or are you just kind of waiting to see what happens?
Yes. So I have had the real honor of meeting the love of my life, and we got married last year. We're very, very happy about that. And at the same time, being married to a U.S. citizen means that as an immigrant, I have the ability to apply for a family-based immigration path that would amount to a green card and a U.S. citizenship, much similar to what the path that I was trying to take with my grandfather, except for spouses, we're in a different category where there aren't as long of a wait time.
So are you looking at years, like a few years, or?
In a normal situation, historically, you know, you're able to get it relatively quickly, from several months to a year. Now, what's been different in this current context is that we've applied this past November, and the USCIS portal, which is this online portal from the government that you can check to see your wait times, it's still saying like 15 months, right? And this wait time, even though as we get closer, we wait longer and longer, the wait time is growing longer and longer. And so there is this inverse relationship that's happening where it's not certain whether or not I'm going to get my green card in a timely manner that people associate with marriage green cards.
Right.
There's a number of things that could be happening based on, you know, the research that I've done and people I've talked to. Large part of it's the federal firing of all the individuals who might be working
the
at
people that do that work do are that not work. There.
That's yeah. Right. So yeah, USCIS Service Center, individuals who might be reviewing my application, there's just not enough of them now.
Yeah.
And so we're in a really serious situation where who knows what's going to happen with even this legal path that I'm taking, right? And so I think in the back of my mind, I know that push come to shove, and for whatever reason, I don't end up receiving a green card and I don't have a legal work authorization, I have to think about plan B. My parents are now in Japan. They self-deported when I was in college. Mm. They gained a lot of health ailments through their difficult manual labor jobs that necessitated them to receive some sort of healthcare access.
Yeah.
And so they moved back to Japan when I was in college. And this, so I send money back home to, you know, pay their rent and their expenses.
Do you basically fully support them?
I fully support them. That's right.
Wow.
And that's one of the financial burdens of being an immigrant with family members that may be depending on you.
Can you share how much you give in remittances to your parents?
Yes.
Say every month?
So right now I deliver around $1,100, $1,200 a month.
It's as if you're like renting an additional apartment or something. Like yeah. It's a sizable amount of money.
It's very sizable, especially when I wasn't making that a lot of money. You know, my first job out of college, I was making around $60,000 a year. And so it was a much bigger chunk of my salary. Thankfully, now the proportion has been better so that it's not more of a financial burden as it was before. But still, yeah, it is like having a separate property you're paying, because, yeah, you are paying for a separate property abroad.
Yeah, you literally are for someone else. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's something a lot of people don't realize who don't have that burden, especially also being an only child. You know, all that burden is on you. It's not spread out between siblings. It's not just, oh, you graduate from college and then it, you know, you just have to take care of yourself. I mean, you've been having to take care of someone else ever since you've been making money, and their retirement plan is you.
That's right.
That's a lot of responsibility. The whole journey you've been on has this huge financial impact for you.
That's right. And for a long time, I felt somehow bitter about it in a lot of ways, because my college roommates or other friends don't have to go through this, and they're able to, you know, save for the stock market, or, you know, put money down on a really great trip to some country abroad and have a great time. And so I felt really sad that I can't enjoy that. But I realized too that this is my story. This is what I have to deal with. And so I think it's a beautiful thing that I've been given this challenge, that I've been able to grow up a little faster, take on a lot more responsibility faster. And so I'm able to understand some of the perils that other people are going through.
Mm-hmm.
And not just immigrants, right? But there are a great number of Americans who have been living paycheck to paycheck, who can't provide for fancy vacations, and who don't have a lot to invest in, like a mutual fund or whatever. They just have to make ends meet. And so I see it as a superpower. I really do.
Yes.
That I've been able to experience this.
And have you seen them since they self-deported?
Oh, man, that is a whole other journey. Unfortunately, because of DACA necessitating a special authorization from the government to leave the country and return, it's been very hard to get permission from the government to travel. But thankfully, under the Biden administration, I was able to leave the country and return. And so
to Japan?
To Japan, yeah. So last mm-hmm. year, I was able to finally see my parents.
After how many years?
After 7 years, 7 years of separation.
Oh, wow.
It was very emotional.
Yeah. And were they able to come to your wedding? I'm guessing not.
They weren't at my wedding, unfortunately, yeah. But I was able to introduce my then fiance to them, which was very nice. One of the most serendipitous parts and also melancholic parts about being separated with your family is you start to notice things about yourself that you may not have when you were young. As in, I realize I kind of look like my dad now, you know, and we share similar mannerisms. And at the same time, you know, you see how they're aging and they're getting older. And so it really made me think about, okay, how do I transition from just being a son to being a provider, being the head of the household? And so I miss them a lot.
How old are you?
I'm currently 28. Yeah.
I don't know if this is too personal, but are you thinking about having kids?
Yes, yeah.
How does that play into all this?
Yeah, I'm going to attend law school in the fall. And so I have been really lucky that I was accepted to Stanford with a full ride scholarship that would pay for my tuition, a stipend that will pay for my housing and living expenses while I attend school.
Congrats.
Thank you. And so as much as, you know, my wife and I want to think about having children and raising a family, certainly law school may not be the best
area.
To do that. So we're thinking, you know, after I graduate from law school and I have another stable job, and, you know, at least we put a down payment on a house and we have all the big necessities that will ensure that the next generation will live in a comfortable environment, we'll then invest in having kids. So family costs money, you know.
Yes.
Having kids costs a lot of money. And I think it is very prudent to plan. But I do think that my life, I've been able to appreciate that some things that may not make financial sense also make sense in terms of our morals or ethics or other values can triumph certain considerations, right? Specifically, it wasn't a financial savvy thing for my parents to stay in America and work as cash basis laborers. But I'm really glad they did that. They sacrificed for me because I've been able to achieve my American dream. You know, I've been able to go to incredible schools, universities, work a job I love. I've met the love of my life. And I was able to do all those things because my parents made the sacrifice. And so I do think that we can't quantify and plan for every single thing. But, you know, money is just one realm of our lives that we must prioritize.
I wanted to transition to a lighter note just for a second. And I actually don't know what your response to this will be. So it'll either be light or not. But when it comes to whenever you have a little bit of discretionary money, whether it's $20 in your wallet or whatever, what do you indulge in? What's something that's just like, I like this and I want to buy it?
Oh, that's a good question. We're big foodies in our family. So we love eating out and spending money to, yeah, not only help small businesses, but to really explore different cuisine, especially Asian cuisine.
Do you have a favorite dish or like a craving, a certain thing you go for?
Oh man, what am I obsessing over now? Right now, I'm really into hot pot. So I love going to places with a big pot of soup or a grill and just like having that communal sense of eating. It's so fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just adds another layer of interaction with your food and with the people around you and their friends, and you're feeding your friends and your family. It's a fun thing.
What does the concept of enough look like to you?
Strictly from a finances perspective, I think if I have enough money that I can comfortably provide for my aging parents, I can comfortably provide for my future children, and that there's enough savings in our bank accounts so that we can, you know, hopefully take that trip abroad and just explore the world, I think I would love it to be able to do that, because I've never really been able to do that growing up, and just feel comfortable in the home that we live in. That feels like enough for me. At the same time, working in immigrant rights advocacy, I've seen how a lot of the change that we see in the world is driven by money. And so I have come to appreciate that in order for me to perhaps seek the change that I want to see in the States, I need to be able to fundraise and I need to be able to finance the projects that I want to endeavor. And so in a personal sense, enough looks like supporting my family and myself with a little bit of, you know, things that we enjoy. But in a professional sense, being able to support a team of people, being able to execute campaigns and, you know, create policy change that I hope to.
Which is no small thing.
That's right.
which is not cheap.
It's not cheap, right.
Well, Daishi, thank you so much for talking to me. This has been really fun, and I really appreciate you taking the time and being here on Other People's Pockets.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been such an honor sharing my story and sharing some of the perspectives that are timely and necessary to highlight during this current moment.
This episode was edited, produced, and mixed by Lane Kaplan-Levinson. Thank you to Pushkin Industries for past production support. If you know someone who would make a great guest on this show, please let me know. Email me at otherpeoplespockets@gmail.com or find me on Instagram or TikTok at It's Maya Money. And as always, please give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. See you soon.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.